So how does negotiation fit in the world of persuasion? What is the difference between the two? Persuasion occurs when your ideas are so convincing that the other party ends up adopting your point of view. With persuasion, there is no compromising as there is a negotiation. Rather, the other party willfully and enthusiastically abandons their position to embrace yours. This abandonment is not brought about by manipulation because the other party clearly sees the gains and advantages of doing business with you. Negotiation, on the other hand, is a process of give and take. Give and take, give and take. We meet somewhere in the middle. It's being able to overcome objections on both sides of an issue and ultimately reaching some common ground. Remember, always persuade first, negotiate second. While persuasion is the ultimate ideal, anytime any one of us is presenting our ideas, the other party is often equally committed to their own convictions, thus making negotiation the next best path. Often, when we hear the word negotiation, we think of a complex deal going on in the business world. In reality, however, all of us are involved in multiple negotiations every day. For example, when you want a steak but your spouse wants lasagna, you may banter back and forth about why one is better than the other. In the end, however, you end up going to a place that offers a bit of both. In that instance, you may not have thought of yourself as negotiating, but that's really what it is. Negotiating is so common in day-to-day life that you must master the skills of great negotiators to become a master persuader. And of course, in the world, there are some negative associations with negotiation. While persuasion is what most of us are striving for, cooperative negotiation can yield win-win situations and should not be overlooked. In the previous example in which the spouses were trying to agree on dinner, both parties win because they end up going to a place that offers both of their dining preferences. Neither party has to compromise. Both parties get what they want. While discussing negotiation in training seminars, I ask the audience what their perceptions of negotiation are. I commonly hear things like two parties ready to fight, frustration, manipulation, long hours, deceit, and the list goes on and on. Despite what my audience members might suggest, there are only four true outcomes of negotiation: the win-win, no deal, the lose-lose, or the win-lose. The problem is that too often we get stuck in the mindset of that negotiation is a game like football or basketball. That is, we think there has to be a clear-cut winner and loser. That mentality, however, does not reflect real negotiation. The truth is, everyone can win a negotiation setting. If we want to use a sports analogy, a better one would be tandem parachuting. Tandem parachuting is where two people jump together, sharing the same parachute. In this sport, like negotiation, you are in it together. You work together, and when you land safely, everybody wins. If you don't, everyone loses. Stephen Covey, author of the best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, is a big advocate of either going for the win-win situation or not going for it at all. If you think about it, if it turned out any other way in negotiations, why would your prospects ever want to do business with you again? Would they recommend you to their friends? Aside from that, it would simply be wrong, and any possible short-term gains would not be worth the damage to your reputation and future business. So, of course, one of the major keys of any negotiation, or persuasion for that matter, is preparation. Preparation is the magic ingredient to all successful negotiations. When negotiating, you have to prepare for anything. You need to know the ins and outs, the intricacies of both sides. The more you prepare, the more knowledge you have, the better you will do. Skills, techniques, and personality will never replace the concrete knowledge that can and will only be gleaned by doing your research and homework before the next negotiation process begins. The bottom line is that the negotiator with the most knowledge is the most prepared, and that is the type of negotiator who will succeed. The bottom line is your negotiation success is determined by your preparation. Before the negotiation begins, you must determine what your needs and interests are. In other words, you must first decide what you want out of the negotiation. Then you must prioritize those needs and wants. The heat of the moment is not the time when you should step back and try to figure out which option you're really pushing for. For example, let's say you just opened your business. You've submitted a bid to a very large corporate entity, and you've been invited in for a meeting concerning your bid. You are excited because landing a client like this will bring great credibility to your new company. You decide beforehand that your greatest needs are to establish more credibility and to increase name recognition. While in the meeting, your prospective client states that if you bring down your bid, you will get the business. The figure they give you will only allow you to break even, but you recognize the significant benefit of having this client on your reference list. So, you lower your price. Going into the meeting, making money was absolutely one of your interests. However, it was not your top priority. You were prepared to handle the situation because you had determined in advance what your number one objective was. By sticking to your plan instead of crumbling under the pressure or emotion of the moment, you have wisely created a way to strengthen your company's credibility and to secure a flow of work in the future. After you have a concrete knowledge of what you want to get out of the negotiation, you need to examine the needs and wants of the other party. Put yourself in their shoes and ask, what would my needs be if I were in their position? Besides thinking the negotiation process through on your own, it is strongly advised that you simply ask what your prospect's needs are. Decrease your margin of error by eliminating guesswork. To be a powerful negotiator is to be exact in addressing all angles of the issue. This step is crucial if you ever hope to reach mutually satisfactory agreements. Your prospect's side of the issue needs to bear as much weight in your mind as your side does. Certainly, a demonstrated interest in and knowledge of their perspective, their circumstances, and their objectives will get you much further than strictly a one-sided presentation. Be assured that one-sidedness will only be seen as short-sightedness. How can your prospects collaborate with you if they aren't confident in your ability to see, understand, and appreciate their primary objective and goals? After having thoroughly accounted for the key issues on both sides, it is time to prepare a number of different proposals on how you see the two sides coming together. This is the time where it's important to think creatively. Don't just divide the pie evenly. Rather, seek out ways to expand the pie. What I mean is that you must be prepared not only to fulfill each party's bottom line, but also to increase the benefits to all involved. Placing yourself in a position to over-deliver is never a bad thing. It will only be met by pleasant surprise. Better still, it is then often followed by cooperation. After you've devised a few creative alternatives that could possibly satisfy both parties' needs, you are ready to narrow down your list of options. Which agreement is most beneficial and fair to both parties? Establishing a standard of fairness is often a very difficult process for negotiators. That's because each side has their own subjective perception of fairness. In such cases, it is recommended that an independent standard be sought. In other words, what's accepted in the industry? When preparing and doing your homework, look at the industry standards, market rates, cost analysis, and other neutral indicators that will enable you to establish a standard of fairness during your negotiation process. So after all these steps, you might be thinking, okay, let's come up with the perfect plan. Let's go in and knock them dead. Well, that's not quite right. No matter how brilliant your projections seem, you must set up three alternative negotiation plans. Too often, people go into negotiations with only one alternative in mind. When that alternative is not acceptable to the other party, then the situation gets sticky. Since the negotiator didn't prepare any other options, they're stranded with nowhere to go. Like I talked about before, the emotion of the moment is not the time when you want to be making weighty decisions. To prevent yourself from being backed into a corner, be sure to have alternative agreements in mind that will still meet your most important needs, wants, and goals. Equally crucial to the preceding steps is the final negotiation step of mental rehearsal. A wise and skilled negotiator will never enter into negotiation unrehearsed. It is of prime importance that you have practiced all the likely scenarios you will encounter and that you have prepared to handle any possible turns with skill and finesse. Don't underestimate the power of visualization. Play out the entire meeting from beginning to end. Think about it. What could happen? What is your opponent's initial perception of you and your offer? What roadblocks could you hit? Could you articulate the opponent's view and concern about the issues at hand? What are your opponent's needs? What has happened in the past? What will they ask for? Will your personalities clash? When you are prepared for negotiation, your stress and your fear will subside. You might feel some pressure. That's okay, but you will not lose control. Going through a pre-negotiation process creates a map for you to follow in any type of terrain you might encounter. Armed with advanced preparation, you will overcome any potential obstacles placed in your path. Find a way for all sides to achieve their goals, feel satisfied with the negotiation, and find a resolution. Now, if you find yourself not being able to reach your needs, and if there still seems to be a considerable amount of distance between you and the other party, do yourself a favor, get up and leave. Too often, less experienced negotiators continue to negotiate after this point has been reached, and if they blindly forge forward, they may reach an agreement, but later realize that not even one of their needs were met. Be careful you don't commit any of the following negotiation errors. So we watch negotiators, these come up time and time again, and these will sabotage you. No, being politically incorrect, showing any type of disrespect, any form of miscommunication, wrong word choice, an irritating style, having no or poor agenda, personalizing the negotiation, revealing too much information too fast, becoming emotionally involved, the desire to destroy the other side, or maybe sometimes exhibiting perceived cockiness. And on the flip side, top negotiators are firm. They know how to use silence. They stay focused and perceptive. They're very attentive. They never rush. They have plenty of energy. They know that it's okay to lose a few battles if that means to win the war. They avoid unnecessary humor, and they get plenty of sleep. And another question I hear many times is, okay, in negotiation, what about face-to-face? Should we do it by phone or should we do it by email? Well, the answer is it depends. You know, in our age of ever-expanding communication possibilities, researchers have been drawn to answer the question of which communication mode is most likely to lend itself to successful negotiation. Well, face-to-face communication is more likely to alleviate any possibility of miscommunication or deception. When you're actually there in person, you're more apt to pick up all the nuances of the exchange. That way, you'll be better able to gauge what the other party is thinking and to determine the direction in which the negotiation is heading. For the same reasons, it is also easier to create and maintain rapport. If there's already a fair amount of tension in the air, however, negotiating by phone can take the edge off, provide a little breathing room, and can minimize the effectiveness of any pressure tactics that may have been employed. And then there's email. The main advantage is that both parties have control over exactly what they want to say and how they're going to say it. Since there's no ebb and flow of the live conversation, the involved parties can keep the floor as long as they want. Now, on the flip side, emailing can tend to make the negotiating parties less restrained and more impulsive in their communication. This rashness isn't always a bad thing, but it definitely can be if tensions exist. Now, one study on negotiation found that when emailing, abrupt and unmannerly exchanges occurred 102 times when negotiating via email, as opposed to only 12 times when negotiating face-to-face. There's some pros, there's some cons. Choose the ones that'll work best for you. And for many situations, it's going to be a combination of all three. One thing I want you to watch out for and think about is what I call the negotiation hazard, is when you push too hard and you don't even know it. Negotiation hazards tend to occur when you're taking a particular strategy too far. What might work wonderfully in one negotiation situation will not always be appropriate in another. The instant someone feels cheated, misled, or taken advantage of, your opportunity to negotiate with them is over. Many rookie negotiators have a tendency to push the envelope a little too far. Their ambition as beginners is understandable, but it rarely results in a win-win situation. Negotiating rookies want to be the victors. They're like hunting prey. Even if the other party consents, they are likely not doing so without some serious repercussions. High-pressure tactics will most often be read as offensive, condescending, obnoxious, and insulting. Then, trust is lost, and ultimately the ability to negotiate is lost too. You could always tell that you're going too far if your prospects find something you say or do alarming, or if they seem uncomfortable in your presence. Always be sensitive to the mood and rapport of the meeting so you don't find yourself in this situation in the first place. Another thing to consider is power. Power increases your ability to negotiate and persuade. Obviously, however, this persuasive tool can also be improperly used. Manipulating others may get you the immediate results you're looking for, but they're not going to last. If you use manipulation to get your way, you won't have people's respect or friendship. Rather, they'll harbor animosity, resistance, and resentment toward you. There are three major types of power that are used in negotiation. Legitimate power, power that is rightfully earned and rightfully exercised. Authority power, now that's based on external factors such as position, title. And there's psychological power, that is derived from playing off of another's psyche. So let's talk about these three, legitimate, authority, and psychological power, and take a brief but closer look at these various types of power that are used in negotiations. Legitimate power is the hardest type of power to gain during negotiation. Legitimate power continues to influence others even after you've walked away from the negotiating table and your physical presence is gone. Legitimate power is often based on knowledge, that is, your expertise in a certain subject, procedure, or situation. People can often be persuaded if they think you have more expertise in a subject area than they do. For example, lawyers and doctors possess this type of power. People rely on attorneys and physicians' opinions, believe what they say, and trust implicitly what they do because of the extent of their schooling or experience they have. We accept arguments and data from people we assume to have accurate knowledge, whether it's real or perceived. Legitimate power can also be based on your resources. If you have access to key persons, commodities, goods, or services that are valued by others, you hold some power over them. As the saying goes, it's not what you know, it's who you know. Then there's authority power. It is based on how other people view your status in relation to their own. That can be real or perceived. For example, have you ever gone to someone in a store who looked like an employee to ask them for help? Even if you didn't know for sure that they were an employee, somehow they still gave you an impression that they were one to approach for directions. That's an example of authority power based solely on appearance. On the other hand, your boss, the U.S. president, the police officer all wield real authority power by virtue of the positions they hold. Impressive titles are another way in which people hold authority power. When we hear doctor in front of a name, it automatically registers in our minds that the person is important, powerful, and intelligent. We'd love to hear phrases like 2 out of 3 doctors recommend, or 9 out of 10 dentists use this product or service. Then the third form is the psychological power. Some people will play a mind game. Not recommending these, but you have to understand they exist. Psychological power is the ability people have to influence you while disguising their true intentions. People who are adept at using psychological power seek to alter another individual's perceptions. So let's talk about some of the common psychological power techniques you'll encounter. As we talk about these, consider, should you use these? What are you going to do when it happens to you? Just to be prepared for the situation. One we see many times is time pressure. Face it, people are slow at making decisions because they're afraid of making mistakes. Negotiators hate to leave deals open-ended too long because the more the time passes, the more time their prospects have to think of all the reasons why they should walk away. And the reverse is also true. The more quickly you get a commitment out of your prospects, the more likely it is they'll follow through. Basically, people who utilize the psychological tactic are leveraging the moments when emotion is high and the judgment is suspended. It's the get them energized, seal the deal while they're still soaring mentality. It is from this mentality that we get promotions like, this offer only good for the next hour, or this offer won't last long. I remember negotiating a contract for a marketing department of a big corporation. I had a million other things I needed to do, so I felt rushed to hammer out the details of the contract that morning. The person I was negotiating with, on the other hand, had all the time in the world and nowhere to go. We bantered back and forth for 6 hours and still had not reached a solution of the contract we were both happy with. My urgency to leave the meeting affected the terms I was finally able to get. When we're in a hurry, we usually pay more to get what we need. When we need something right now and someone else has it, we will pay whatever it takes to get it. Think of all the convenience stores that cost more. The all-night convenience store charges twice as much for a gallon of milk as the grocery store down the street. Likewise, the 24-hour copy mart charges more than a traditional print service. Think about how much you paid for the book or magazine at the airport before you rush to catch your plane. Being in a hurry definitely costs money, and that's true in negotiation. Being in a hurry will cost you the negotiation. Another technique we see is boldness. Acting with boldness not only emits the perception of confidence to others, but it actually helps you feel more confident about yourself. When you come across as confident, whether you really are or not, people will be much more likely to rally behind you. They will automatically assume that you know what you're doing. Boldness can lead to the accomplishment of unimaginable things, which then in turn makes your confidence more and genuine. When you are on the receiving end of boldness, however, be aware that another's assertiveness is sometimes used as a means of coming across as a better negotiator. People who come across as timid or weak-willed are much less likely to be good at negotiations. Then there's unpredictability. Sometimes negotiators try to use unpredictability to throw the other person off. Face it, humans are creatures of habit. We love the familiar and the predictable. We love routine. So when something unpredictable happens, we feel out of control. Think of a person you know who has an unpredictable personality. You never quite know if they're going to be happy or angry, thankful or resentful, elated or depressed. How do you feel when you're around this person? People sometimes do this on purpose to intimidate you or to feel a sense of control over you. Some negotiators will work through lunch, yell, lose control, or be seen tearing down a colleague. These examples will often throw off rookie persuaders. Be aware of these psychological negotiating tactics that can make you feel intimidated or out of control. And as you know, trust and cultivating a relationship of trust is critical. Try to think of the negotiation process as more of a discussion or an exchange of ideas rather than a competition or a fight. One of the best ways to get your negotiations on the right track is to make sure you cultivate a relationship of trust right from the start. Even the initial small talk that takes place before the actual meeting starts will help your prospects feel comfortable with and more trusting of you. When your prospects trust you, they will be more willing to take necessary risks to help both parties move in a direction that will most greatly benefit everyone involved. If prospects don't trust you, all the evidence, reasoning, facts, figures in the world won't get them to budge. Be sure you listen attentively and carefully to your prospects' concerns. Respectfulness will go a long way toward a successful outcome. One of the advantages of face-to-face meetings is that your prospects will be able to see and experience your sincerity firsthand. Then there are expectations. The fact that people's expectations influence reality can help dramatically in the negotiation process. Individuals tend to make decisions based on how others expect them to perform. When we know someone expects something from us, we try to satisfy them in order to gain respect and likability. You have probably heard the saying, "What gets measured gets done." The same is true for expectations. That which is expected is what usually happens. People rise to meet your expectations of them, thereby turning your expectations into reality. Ever notice how people who think they're going to be fired suddenly experience a drop in the quality and enthusiasm for their work? What happens? You got it. They get fired. Their belief in their impending termination causes them to act in a certain way, and those expectations then work to bring about the very thing that at first was only a figment of their imagination. Numerous studies have shown how expectation dramatically influences people's performance. For example, in one study, girls who were told they would perform poorly on a math test received poor grades. In another, assembly line workers were told that their job was complex, performed less efficiently at the same task than those who were told that the job was very simple. Another case study demonstrated that adults who were given complex mazes solved them faster when told the mazes were based on grade school level of difficulty. Based on these examples, it's clear to see that if you can add the new expectation in your negotiation repertoire, you have one more tool through which you can influence the other party. When using expectation in negotiation, there are two key ways in which the technique can be used easily and effectively: time expectations and reputation expectations. Let's talk about these. The first is time expectations. In our modern world, we are bound by time. This being the case, we have a certain expectations about how long it will take us to accomplish various tasks. Time often becomes distorted through our perceptions and our expectations. Why do some afternoons speed by faster than others? Why do we finish our projects just 1 minute before the deadline? Parkinson's law states that the work expands to fill the time available. So if a project is given a 3-month deadline, it'll take a full 3 months to complete. If the very same project is given a 6-month time frame, it will still take the full 6 months to complete, even though it could be easily completed in 3. It may sound strange, but this law holds weight because the time allotted for completion of a project sets our expectations. It is actually our expectations that influence how we'll work on a project and therefore when it will be completed. Your time expectations going into the negotiation will determine how you negotiate. A word of advice: don't show your cards. Never let the other party know how fast you need to seal the deal. Another thing I want to bring to your attention is self-serving perceptions and biases, because it is a natural tendency for us to take in information and interpret it in a manner that will best serve our personal wants and needs. We do not always do this consciously. What's more, the opposite is true, is that we often pass over information that is critical to understanding the other side, particularly when the other side is in conflict with us. We naturally enhance our own position while vilifying the opposition's. The result is that perceptions and beliefs are based on information that is highly inaccurate and exaggerated. We see this in American politics, between the Israelis and the Palestinians, between the Catholics and the Protestants. Every time when this happens, most sides, you will see they will enhance their own position and always vilify the other side. A famous Harvard study involved giving some executives insider information about one company's plan to acquire another. The executives were randomly assigned to role-play the part of either the buyer or the seller. Unbeknownst to them, the information given to each side was identical. After analyzing the information, the executives each had to give their private assessment of the company's fair value, as opposed to how they might present the value in the negotiations. Now here, follow me on this. Not surprisingly, the executives played the part of the seller, gave values that were more than double those offered by those who were playing the roles of the buyers. It's interesting to note the results were driven by what would best serve the party in their randomly assigned role. It is to be expected that each negotiating side will bring its own biases to the table. Simply knowing that these biases exist will help you stay in the negotiation and not be caught off guard. Put yourself in the other side's shoes and think of what their most powerful case could be. This empathizing tactic always sheds light on new thoughts and ideas that you might not have thought of otherwise. Finally, it will never hurt you to seek the input of an uninvolved third party, because you need to understand that it's natural when you're negotiating with a person you don't know very well for them to regard you with some suspicion. In negotiation, it will be the other party's instinct to assume the worst about your motives. There could be a million legitimate reasons why we have to hold out for an offer, but instead of considering what any of those reasons might be, people are much more inclined to draw negative conclusions. For example, if you cannot agree to the terms, your negotiation partner may automatically decide that you're greedy, demanding, or unreasonable without even stopping to consider what the other factors might be at work in your inability to agree to terms. Because of these suspicious tendencies, it is imperative that you reduce the likelihood of misunderstandings in your negotiation efforts by clearly stating what you need. It would be horrible to lose out on a deal altogether just because someone misunderstood you and deduced that you were untrustworthy. Now understand, if you can give clear reasons why your stance is what it is, your negotiation counterpart has the opportunity to process this information and respond more favorably. In this way, you enhance understanding, open communication, and trust. The next is reputation expectations. The most effective psychological tool of getting someone to follow through on a promise is to let them know that you believe they're the type of person who will follow through. Using phrases such as, you're the kind of person who, or you've always impressed me with your ability to, or I've always liked the fact that you, and of course you fill in the blank. These all invoke the powerful psychological law of internal consistency. For example, Winston Churchill, one of the greatest masters in dealing with people, said, I have found the best way to get another to acquire virtue is to impute it to them. When people are aware of good opinions others have about them, they want to live up to those opinions. This tendency is why we act out the roles that are assigned to us. If we receive praise, we want to be worthy of that praise. There was a police officer who always seemed to be able to get even the toughest criminals to open up and tell them everything. His technique was to tell the criminal, I know you have the reputation for being the tough guy who's been in a lot of trouble, but everyone tells me one thing that stands out about you is that you never lie. They tell me that whatever you say is always the truth, no matter what. Seems simple, but very powerful. So honestly assess how you think you make others feel when they're around you. Do you make them feel small and unimportant, or do you inspire them to achieve more? Your action towards others will tell them how you feel or think about them. It's been said, treat a man as he appears to be and you make him worse, but treat a man as if he already were what he potentially could be and you make him what he should be. Reputation is everything in negotiation. Have you ever noticed how the people you assume are going to be tough turn out to be just that? And if there's someone you're especially excited to meet, then when you do meet them, they seem great? Often our assumptions and our expectations about someone we're going to meet for the first time are exactly what plays out, because we mentally conceived what they would be like. When first meeting someone, you need to send out subconscious messages about how they should respond to you and how they should behave. Critical that you understand this information. And on another note, too, it all comes back to structure. Why should you be concerned with the structure of your negotiation? So let's talk about some basic guidelines so you know how to put together a negotiation presentation. There basically is an overview, 5 points to a persuasive presentation. The first is create interest. Make sure the other party is interested in what you have to offer. What's in it for them? How can you help them be open to negotiation and create a win-win resolution? 2, state the problem. Clearly define the problem you intend to alleviate. Relate your understanding of how the need or problem affects the other party so they know that you understand exactly where they're coming from. 3, offer evidence. Support and validate your claims and concerns. Expand your credibility by giving the other side additional sources to rely on besides you. Evidence can include examples, statistics, stories, testimonies, analogies, and any other supporting material that is used to enhance the integrity and congruency of your negotiation efforts. The 4th, present a solution. Clearly and convincingly present how your solution will meet their needs and will help them achieve their goals and objectives. And 5, agreement. After showing them how you can fulfill their needs, your prospects should be interested in pursuing the deal further. Then a discussion of terms naturally follows. Work out terms that are agreeable to all. Using this type of structure facilitates people's acceptance of what you have to offer. We all have a logical side to our minds, which results in our need for order and arrangement. If you can't be clear and concise and orderly, the negotiation will be unclear, non-concise, and disorderly, and as you've probably heard, a confused mind says no. We also know it's important the words you use as you look at this structure. Remember, it was create interest, state the problem, offer evidence, present a solution, and then agreement. The more skillful a person is in the use of language, the more persuasive they will be in a negotiating setting. People are persuaded by the words we use and how we use them. Since even a single word can affect an individual's perception about a negotiator and what they are trying to negotiate, negotiators choose their words especially carefully. For example, and think about each word you're going to use. We never use contract. How about agreement? Let's have a meeting versus time to get together. Sign here versus okay this or autograph this. cancellation versus right of rescission, cost versus investment, ruling versus resolution, problem versus challenge, objections versus concern, service charge versus processing fee. It might seem like a little thing, but it matters. Every word you use will attract or distract from your message. Your word choices will paint different pictures for different people because the way in which we define words is based on our belief system, our past experiences, and our social roles. The association we hold about a certain word or combination of words will dictate our actions and how we respond to them. For example, some cultures view death as a celebration of life, while others view death as a tragedy. Sometimes, if used improperly, positive words can still lead to a negative response. For this reason, negotiators will often avoid certain words that are generally positive and instead use words that may bear positive associations but are more ambiguous. For example, in the world of politics, we hear phrases like freedom of choice, fiscal responsibility, or responsible taxation. When politicians use such generalities, people of differing viewpoints can actually all be appeased. Those individuals hearing these words fill in the blanks and provide their own usable personal definitions. So, verbal packaging, careful of any jargon or technical language. Never use profanity or slang. Of course, we don't want to be offensive, profane. We don't want to start name calling. Use everyday basic language. Utilize language that will make you seem familiar and easy to follow. Keep your sentences short. Don't use vague and abstract words. Don't talk down to the other party by using pompous and pretentious words. Be direct, don't bluff or beat around the bush. And use verb-driven language. By using verb-driven language, you will arouse a greater sense of action and motivation in your prospects. Your statements will always sound more convincing. Verbs that are abstract or overused do not communicate excitement. Another aspect, of course, is acceptance, connecting with others, developing rapport, having people skills. If people don't like you, you will not be able to negotiate and persuade with them. Because we've all had the experience of feeling an instant connection or bond with someone after just a few seconds of being in their presence. This is connectivity. This is rapport. The more we feel connected to, part of, liked by, or attracted to someone, the more persuasive they become. As we feel more comfortable, a natural sense of trust ensues. This ability to work well with people tops a list of common skills and habits that highly successful negotiators use. Something basic like people skills are crucial because they have a huge impact on our success. And most people aren't that good with people skills, and they think they are. First impressions are made within only 4 minutes of initial interaction with a stranger, so we don't have time to not have good people skills. One of the most important characteristics to show up in front of a negotiation is goodwill. Goodwill means being caring, kind, sensitive, and thoughtful. It means demonstrating genuine interest in others instead of focusing on how to get them interested in you. Be a good listener, and you're not. You might think you are, but this is a huge one. Learn to listen. Learn to listen with your ears, your eyes, and your heart. This kind of compassion and empathy will win you loyalty from all those you come in contact with. Negotiation's not a war. You can also hone your abilities to interact with others by using appropriate body language. Whether we realize it or not, we are constantly reading and being read by others. Even without the utterance of words, the language of the body speaks volumes. Always be mindful that everything about you, be it flamboyant or subtle, communicates something about you to somebody else. The words you use, your facial expressions, what you do with your hands, your tone of voice, level eye contact, all contribute to the way people feel about you. Consequently, they also play a role in how likely they will to accept your message. And I mentioned earlier, listening. Most people think it's a waste of time. You didn't learn to listen in school. Poor listening skills account for the majority of people's negotiation problems. Good listening is not just looking at someone and nodding your head in agreement. You have to acknowledge what is being said and let the other person know that you understand. The more you can acknowledge what is being said by others, the greater your ability to negotiate. Why? Because the person speaking with you will feel important and understood. So why is listening so difficult for most of us? Well, the top five challenges to effective listening during a negotiation are, first, always thinking about your response or comeback. Instead of thinking about what the other person is saying, we think about what we want to say next or where we want the negotiation to go. Thinking about your stance on an issue or why the other side is wrong is an obstacle to effective listening. Next is not concentrating. We talk at the rate of 120 to 150 words per minute, but we can think to as high as 800 words per minute. As a result, we often act like we're listening when we're really thinking of something else. Stay focused during your negotiations. Next is jumping to conclusions. Sometimes we assume that we know exactly what the other side is going to say next. As a result, we begin forming reactions based on those assumptions. In other words, we begin putting words into our fellow negotiator's mouth. Another is prejudging based on delivery or even appearance. We're not supposed to judge, but we do. We judge people by the way they look or speak instead of listening to what they say. Some people, not saying that it's right, are put off by personal appearance, regional accents, speech defects, and mannerisms, and they don't even try to listen to a message a person is trying to convey. And the big piece, I think, is lack of training. Some people have never even been to a training or guidance on how to listen effectively. They think they've picked it up, they can figure it out on their own. As a result, they don't realize the mental effort or level of involvement required to be a great listener. If you know how to listen, you'll always know what someone is thinking. You'll also always know what they want from you. So when you talk to great negotiators, this is what they say about listening. First, they say, give the other side your undivided attention. Make them feel like they're the most important people in the world to you at that very moment in time. Another is look them directly in the eye while they're talking. Lean forward to indicate interest and concern. Listen calmly. Another, show sincere interest in them. There's no need to talk. Just nod your head to agree with verbal sounds like, uh-huh, and I understand. Another is keep the conversation going by asking questions. Prompt more information for them by repeating their phrases. Use silence to encourage them to talk. You've all heard that silence is golden, and that is true in negotiation. Being silent encourages all parties to talk about themselves and to reveal important information that will help you during the negotiation process. And always pause before replying. Wait 3 to 5 seconds and then reply thoughtfully. Don't leap in, even if you know the answer. When you pause, it shows the other person that you consider what they are saying to be valuable. Sometimes we enhance our listening capability by honing our watching. As a negotiator, it is crucial to be very attentive to the cues and signals that the other party may be sending out in addition to the words they are saying. For example, when the other party nods and says yes, is that sincere agreement or polite diplomacy? It is far too easy to get caught up in our end of the bargain and miss the valuable signals and information that are being sent by the other party about how they really feel. Another power tool in your negotiation toolbox is the use of questions. Questioning is probably the one that is most often used by great negotiators. Questions create involvement, guide the conversation, set the pace of the conversation, clarify statements and objections, determine beliefs, attitudes, values, uncover the party's thoughts and needs, and show your sincerity. Is that enough for you? It's critical. Studies show, as they observe negotiators in action, this is what they're finding. The key finding is that skilled negotiators ask more than twice as many questions as average negotiators. If you are probing for lots of information, it is best to keep your questions open-ended. The more open-ended the question, the more information you are likely to get. This questioning strategy deters a person from being able to simply say yes or no. With open-ended questions, the other person will be doing most of the talking. Then their answers can lead into more detailed questions without you seeming too intrusive. Be prepared to field questions that the other side will ask and want to know. Brainstorm ahead of time for possible questions, scenarios, and answers you will encounter. There will always be tough questions. If you are the expert, you are expected to know the answers. Obviously, if you don't know the answers, you should not make one up. How do you save yourself from losing credibility? One is to throw the question back and ask for their insights or opinions. Another strategy is to ask to have the question repeated. This stalling technique gives you more time to think of a response. Restate the question and ask if it is correct. Such a strategy will also help you make sure you understand the question. Remember that the person with whom you're negotiating may answer all your questions, but still hold back pertinent information simply because you did not directly ask for it. Your negotiation partner is not going to volunteer crucial information just out of charity. It is imperative that you thoroughly prepare in advance so you know when to ask, what to ask, and who to ask. If you think of something important that the other party did not disclose, you have all the more reason to be watchful and wary. And when you ask questions, sometimes that triggers objections. And it will always happen when you get people involved in the negotiation process. You will get some objections. The way in which you handle objections will correlate with how mentally involved people become with your message. The better you become at handling objections, the more persuasive you will become at negotiating. The key to great negotiation is anticipating all objections before you hear them. Fielding questions and handling objections can make or break you as a negotiator. Such skills will help you in every aspect of your life. So how do you handle an objection? First and foremost is find out if it's something you can solve. Second, let the other side state their objections. Hear them out completely without interruption. Third, always ask the opposing side to restate their key points, letting them speak, particularly if they are upset, strains emotions from their objections. Allowing them to voice their concerns also gives you time to think of a response. Number four, skillful negotiators will always find some point of agreement with their counterparts. It's important to recognize the apprehension of objections people have instead of ignoring them. Five, stay calm. Scientific tests have proven that a calmly stated facts are more effective in getting people to change their minds than being emotional. Six, don't be arrogant or condescending. This will close the doors to any negotiation. And seven, understand human nature. Give the person room to save face. People will often change their minds and agree with you later. It could be just that they didn't have all the facts, that they misunderstood you, or you didn't explain everything correctly. Because the whole point of this negotiation process is to get a win-win, is to find that agreement. The agreement is the most important part of your negotiation. It's highly recommended that you have the resulting agreement put in writing, including what the consequences will be if either side does not live up to its own end of the bargain. This is what the negotiation process is about, finding the win-win solution. Coming to a resolution does not have to take weeks, months, or years. Agreeable negotiations can finish in days or even hours. Remember, we persuade first, we negotiate second. This is one of the tools you have in your persuasion toolbox. Sometimes you will have to learn to negotiate and do it the right way. Be prepared, follow these guidelines, and you'll see a big difference in your ability to persuade, negotiate, and influence.